Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
So today, government subsidies. It's interesting how we complained about paying money to the EU for that money to be spent on subsidies, some of which came back to the UK, and that was all big news because we didn't have control over where that money was going. But now Britain wants to set up its own subsidy programme, and it's not even registering in the news agenda. So as the UK government published the UK Subsidy Control Bill, what should subsidies look like? We'll look at that today on the podcast, and what subsidies are needed. All of that in the next half hour on the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. Well, you know, it's probably got lost in amongst all the other news about COVID and the fact that the UK is about to go back to life as normal, even though the rising infection numbers are getting bigger every day. But this week, the UK government announced a new approach to subsidies to replace the approach taken by the EU. It's all down to the Subsidy Control Bill. Not heard about this? No, I'm not surprised. There's not been a peep about it in the media. The description from the UK government is the Subsidy Control Bill provides the framework for a new UK-wide subsidy control regime. It's all about control for everybody apart from the federal government. This regime will enable public authorities, including devolved administrations and local authorities, to deliver subsidies that are tailored and bespoke for local needs to deliver government priorities such as levelling up and achieving net zero carbon, says the description, as well as supporting the economy's recovery from COVID-19. So these are the rules set by the government by which all authorities, right down to local authorities, must adhere to if they're to give any form of subsidy to anyone. You know, you would have thought this would be something worthy of a bit of a public attention, wouldn't you? But as I say, not a peep on it in the media. No public discourse whatsoever. It doesn't, of course, include the big federal level subsidies, like how much we pay train companies or how much the UK government paid Nissan to stay in Sunderland after Brexit. That's all secret squirrel stuff. But if the Scottish government wants to spend any money whatsoever to offer a subsidy, then that needs to go onto the publicly available database, which is part of this subsidy control bill. And if you're interested in this sort of stuff, because some of them are a little bit esoteric, I have to say, then you can go and look it up and see what money is being spent where, apart from, you know, the big amounts being spent by the central government. So the fact that we have subsidies at all, Steve, I mean, this is a recognition that the economic system that Adam Smith described doesn't work, does it? I mean, it doesn't look after itself, the economy. The government clearly needs to step in and spend money. This is an admission of defeat, isn't it, for pure economics?
Well, you've got economic theory, which really begins not so much with Adam Smith as with the neoclassicals arguing that don't touch the price system. Let the market determine prices and you'll get the best of all possible worlds type outcome. And that is what dominates neoclassical economics in general, and it therefore dominates economic policy about trade regulations and so on. So this is just in some ways this is determined not by the needs of industry or government, but by the needs of economic theory, because they're trying to say, well, any subsidies at all distort the market outcome, and so the only type of subsidies they'd allow are ones where they regard the market as being insufficient in its own right, and that normally relates to the absence of property rights. So if you look at the way they try to handle carbon dioxide generation and pollution in general, they say, well, that's an externality. The people who pollute get a benefit. They don't have to pay for the cost of the pollution. So you want to penalise those. And equally, if you have, you know, the classic example they give is bee farmers. Bee farmers get rewarded by selling the honey, but they don't get rewarded by fertilising all the plants that the bees fertilise to make the honey. And therefore, we don't have as many bees as we should have, and therefore subsidies will make the market system work as if there was a property right for fertilisation of of plants. Mm. And that's the sort of logic behind this whole approach to trying to control subsidies.
Right. But we also know that if you didn't have subsidies, unless there were subsidies like that, which are correcting things that are not accounted for in the economic system, that's what that's saying, isn't it, really? It's like we, you know, that no money is exchanged in the fertilizing of plants, so we need to ensure money does change hands to make sure that the system is balanced. But we know that even if the system was supposedly balanced like that, we'd still have poor people getting poorer, rich people getting richer, old industries continuing and new industries not replacing them because they can't compete against the power of the old industries. You know, a whole load of entrenched ways the economy operates, which would be impossible to break through without the use of subsidies.
Well, I mean, economists are always going to push back against that. Neoclassical ones, obviously, not so much me, because they'll say that, you know, any market intervention has to be tested to show whether it generates social benefits or not. And this is really, I think, that law, it sounds to me like it's been framed by a bunch of neoclassical economists saying, yeah, we want to allow subsidies, but we don't want them to distort the market system. And that's what I imagine those regulations are about. But the problem, and this comes down to, is it true that a free market grows faster than one that has regulations or subsidies? And the empirical data is categorical that no, that's not true. When you look at countries which have been successful in growing, you know, from very underdeveloped states, like Japan, South Korea, China, and so on, Germany as well, at various stages in industrialization, and for that matter, America, what you find is that the period of growth often coincides with quite strong government intervention to basically, when you look at national laws, to twist the playing field in favor of local producers, but to put them under pressure so that they have to industrialize and develop very quickly. So... you know, I don't think there's any, there wouldn't be any awareness of the potential nation-building role of subsidies in that bill, I would expect.
No. Well, I think it's, I mean, part of the bill I get, because if you click on the website for it, you can see 300 or 350 subsidy projects from local authorities and national governments, like for Scotland, for example, where they are putting money behind projects, and you're thinking, what is the point of that? So, for example, in North Yorkshire, there's a bit of government money that's gone into supporting the building of an industrial park. You know, you think, well, surely the industrial park can, you know, it's going to be charging people to be there. Surely it can make its own way. And then there's an example of the Scottish government giving money to WHP Telecoms, which are, I think are basically a telecoms infrastructure provider. They're giving them £16 million. This is the Scottish government for a 4G infill program. And they list some of the places where this infill program is operating, and a little town, in a little village, I should say, of Little Mill. The name says it all, doesn't it? Population of 35.
Little Mill, yeah. Okay.
Little Mill.
How many people?
35.
Okay.
It's very close to Nairn in Nairnshire, but now they've got a 4G mobile site, which is being retailed through EE. There's 21 sites so far. That's an example of one of them. 16 million of government money's gone into that. You're thinking, well, you know, if it's not, in that case, if it's not commercially viable, sorry, people of Little Mill, move to Nairn. You can get 4G coverage there.
No, I'm going to come out swinging for Little Mill here. I'm actually going to use an example. You and I, you being ex-Aussies, I hope you remember this one. Ever heard of a guy called Kerry Packer?
Yes, of course.
Okay,
yep.
Okay. You know Kerry Packer died?
Yeah.
Twice?
Yeah, well, his helicopter pilot gave him a spare lung, didn't he?
No, that's actually
been
two
kidney,
and a half
sorry.
Times. No, he died once on the polo field.
Okay.
He had a heart attack. He died. And he was revived because the ambulance passing that happened to be in the region at the time had a defibrillator. So they hit him with that. He came back to life again. He, by the way, swore after there was no life after death. It was just blank until he got reactivated by the Frankenstein switch. And His response to that, and this is one, you know, sometimes your capitalist overlords aren't entirely bad. He then purchased a defibrillator for every ambulance in Australia. And the logic being that you don't know where you're going to have a heart attack. Now, yeah. The same sort of thing applies to, telecommunications coverage. You don't know when you're going to run out of signal. So if you say, if you look at like a town of Mill, down, is this what, down Mill, 14 day?
Little
14
mill.
Hours a day? Little Mill, okay, pardon me. Maybe they worked 18 hours a day in Little Mill. Sorry for the Monty Python reference. But you don't know whether you're going to need that in that location. But if you make a commercial decision about it, you don't put the cable in there, because what's the point of providing, you know, an expensive telecommunications infrastructure to 14 people? But at the same time, partly the existence of that infrastructure is partly what defines a civilized society.
Yeah.
And another classic instance, I remember that which very vividly, with my first wife had good friends living in the Hills District of Sydney, and the average property there was 5 acres, so we're not talking poor here. But 5 acres means there's a large amount of land between each house. There aren't many houses. And so when both Telstra and your old company, Optus, were competitively laying optical fibre to cable TV back in those days, neither of them put it down that street.
Mm. No, they all competed against each other and put them down the same street.
That was
the problem. So they had overbuild, absolutely. So I didn't work at I worked at Aussie Mail. I never worked at.
Apologies.
I did apply once. Applied for a job at Optus. They weren't interested. Okay. And even though I'd actually at Aussie Mail was actually selling more broadband connections than they were when I was marketing. But anyway, their choice. But okay. I mean, it's interesting talking about telecommunications in Australia, because the NBN is a great example, isn't it, of a subsidy.
Oh, total. Well, not a subsidy.
But the idea was that they would build out a national network. The government would build the network, and subsidies were part of the problem with it, because they basically said, well, we want it to be the same everywhere in the country, so you pay the same for a connection in Dubbo as you would if you are in Edgecliffe, for example, in Sydney's east. So the cost of running the expense of connecting people in the country was basically acted as a cross subsidy from people in the city. So in effect, people in the cities were paying more for broadband than they would if it had been an open slather competition, because basically this was operating as a monopoly. And the surplus profit from that was used to cross-subsidize providing what would be a non-commercial service in the country. So what that meant was everybody ended up with more expensive broadband than they would otherwise. And I think the comparison with that is the argument. I'm not saying whether that's right or wrong, but the comparison is with the argument that was given when we privatized the railways in the UK, because then exactly the same thing was happening. There was very efficient mainline services like up the east and west coast lines of Britain, which were very profitable. And those profits were used, when it was all British Rail, to subsidize the non-profitable services. So the amount of government subsidy was reduced. And then I think it was the Thatcher government, wasn't it, surprisingly, that said, no, we should... we should privatise the railways so that because the way it should operate, those East Coast and West Coast main lines should be able to run as profitable enterprises, because that will make them, be more innovative, supposedly. And the government will subsidise those other services, and those other services, without this cost subsidy coming, may actually become more effective themselves. So it's the same argument in both directions, isn't it? Which is the right one?
Well, I mean, the classic, we both know the state of British Rail, and that's catastrophic. Mm. And not only is it the worst rail service in Europe, it's owned by the national governments of the other countries in Europe, which was a crazy outcome.
Yeah.
And Hong Kong, yeah. I think Singapore's in there as well. It's absolutely crazy. So, the whole idea that this would improve to an improved situation by getting rid of cross subsidies, or by making the subsidies explicit and allowing profitability to apply in other words, that's one of the greatest catastrophes of market-oriented planning I think you can possibly come up with.
Well, so the Labour Party, figures from the Labour Party in late 2018, they said the direct subsidy of railways has increased 200% since privatisation, and fares are 20% higher in real terms than they were in January 1995. So, yeah, it's not working, is it?
Although it failed left, right and centre. The advocates say
the traffic numbers have doubled. From 1992 to 2017, there's twice as many people on the trains, but perhaps that's because there's a lot more people in the country.
How many more English are there? Yeah, I mean, and who can't afford the roads. I mean, it was a classic case where market ideology ended up creating a catastrophe. And this, you know, this is why I'm always sceptical when I hear things like this law about trying to regulate subsidies, because they're all based on the idea that the neoclassical vision of a competitive market is the one that works best. But even that, like one of the weaknesses, and we're touching on it by just talking about Little Mill and the railways and so on, as well as being not taking time seriously, it doesn't take space seriously either. So you don't actually look at, you know, what you imagine the economy all takes place at a particular, you know, one little point. Well, it doesn't. It's distributed over an enormous area. And one of the best pieces of non-conventional economics was Hotelling's little proof that if you had a linear beach and you had an ice cream distributor on that beach, then the sensible location in a competitive market is for that ice cream producer to be right in the middle of the beach. Now, if you then have a second ice cream provider turning up, then for the people on the beach itself, imagine they're uniformly distributed, the best location for the two ice cream outlets is one third and two thirds of the way along the beach. But if let's say they actually do that initially, well, the first one of those providers to move right next door to the other provider gets two thirds of the market. And actually more than two-thirds of the market. So if you let competitive behaviour occur, you'll end up, because you have this geographic distribution of where people live and where services have to be delivered, you'll end up disadvantaging society. So it's a strong, even just taking into account the fact that space exists is a reason not to go along with these attempts to regulate subsidies.
Right. So in that example then, if you've got one ice cream provider in the middle and then another one wants to come along, should you be saying to the first one, we're going to subsidise you to move your operation so that you're one third of the way along the beach, so that this other person can be two thirds, so that everyone gets everyone
something
is
of that nature. The regulations matter. We're obviously imagining mobile stands here, but this is the type of thinking. Once you take into account the existence of space, what you learn in the first year of a textbook should be thrown into space. And that's the problem. The people drafting this stuff swallow the simplistic views of the first year economics textbook, or even worse, the second, third, and fourth year economics textbooks. And when they get worse as they get older, not better. And you end up with something which ends up, you know, with things like that, the situation with the laying of optical fibre back in Australia in the Hawke Keating days. You know, it was crazy.
Exactly that did what you're describing with the ice cream vendors, isn't it? They both went next to each other rather than taking
out. You got double provision where there was dense population and zero provision where there was low population levels, but you wanted it throughout the entire country.
But this idea of cross subsidy, though, so the NBN is an interesting example, which is not replicated.
National Broadcasting Network for those poor people.
National Broadband Network. Sorry, so it's
broadband.
I mean, very briefly, the Australian government decided, and it's been through many political versions of how it was going to be delivered. But initially, the idea was that the government would foot the bill to produce a whole new optical fibre network. Fibre network from the home into everyone's home, basically, rather than the existing copper networks. And so it would be a brand new build in competition to the network that Telstra, the incumbent, already had. And it was very expensive to do it that way. And so in the end, there was a change of government. They decided they wanted a cheaper alternative and they were going to use the Telstra network.
Let's not let the Liberals off the hook here. Tony Abbott decided to massacre Kevin Rudd by pushing and saying his fibre to the, rather than taking optical fibre to the house, you take it to the street and then run cable off it, would be faster and cheaper. It's been neither. It's been a disaster all the way through.
Very expensive and very slow is the upshot.
Very slow, yeah. And this is, again, this is where I have a certain sympathy for the attitude that economists have towards politicians. Don't let politicians get their hands on the... On the purse strings, because they'll use it to pork barrel. Well, that's been absolutely true, but the trouble is the greatest examples of it have in fact been the ones who claim to be market advocates, the so-called liberals in Australia and the conservatives in the UK, and for that matter, the Republicans in America. So the ones saying don't let it, we shouldn't let this happen, are the ones who actually end up doing it.
Aside from all of that, just the idea, just looking at the idea, irrespective of how it was developed and the efficiencies or otherwise in which it was implemented, there is another way, isn't there, where you could actually say, because what actually happened was, in the end, they did say, well, okay, we're not going to be a monopoly. We will allow other providers in. But if those other providers want to deliver broadband in the cities, then they are going to have to pay, in effect, a tax, because we are cost-subsidizing people in the country to get their more expensive connection. So if you just want to do the low-hanging fruit, then you're going to have to pay that cost subsidy. And it was something like £5 per connection, or $5, I should say, per connection per month, which added a lot to the had to be passed on to the consumer, which made it very expensive for everybody. There was another argument from an economist, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what you think about this at the time, saying, well, actually, wouldn't it be smarter to say that it's open, we'll allow competition? Because there is an argument to say you can have infrastructure competition. It's worked pretty well in the UK, for example. It doesn't work so well when you get into regional areas in Australia, obviously. But to say, if you want to roll out there and, carry the extra cost, rather than giving a subsidy to the company, we'll give the subsidies to the consumer. So we'll say to the consumer, if you want to get broadband, here's a broadband grant, and you can use that to buy from whoever you want. So the subsidy is passed through the consumer, and you allow companies to operate more efficiently. That way, you get over the issue about companies perhaps saying, "Oh, I've got a government subsidy now. Pressure's off us. We don't need to be quite as efficient as we would if we're working in a pure free market."
Yeah, and that's quite reasonable. And I think you can also, one of my favourite examples of a good meld of government regulation with the private sector was South Korea's telecommunications rollout. I think I've told the story before, but it's still one I find so amusing. I can still see it happening. The leader of the Communist Party of South Korea became interested in my work on Marx and came out to spend 6 months with me back when I was working at University of Western Sydney. And, he was a classic Stalinist type, not a bad guy, but oh my God, I'd seen those personalities in Politburos before. Anyway, when I got him to the house he was renting, the first thing he did was pull out his T45 cable, Ethernet cable, and go walking around the walls trying to find where to plug it in. I had to finally tell him there was no thing. We're just using telephone cable network, and he was horrified at how primitive Australia was, and then told me that in South Korea, the government told the industry body, this is all the names we now know as, Samsung and so on, the major Korean corporations that are now global players in telecommunications, told them they didn't care how they did it, but they had to provide, if they wanted to continue operating in South Korea, they had to get together and collectively make sure that every house in South Korea had an Ethernet connection for the internet. Now, if you're wondering why Samsung has become so powerful and why South Korea became such a leading player, that's a pretty damn good example. And that's one case where there's the creative role for the state in generating, but, which is the sort of Maria Mazzucato hammers on about, regulations like the one we're discussing probably ignore.
So the question about developing new industries or new infrastructure, but you've got the issue about picking winners, haven't you? You've got the issue about governments picking winners. I'm not quite sure how you get over that, because politicians aren't always necessarily the smartest people on the planet.
Well, that's where your proposal that it comes down to maybe giving the consumer a certain amount of choice there, and then having the companies compete for it. I mean, again, if you look at in America with the space race right now, the absurdity of the gap between the cost level of Musk's Starship versions of how to get to the moon versus what's happening with the what they're called the ULA and the government elements, and then Bezos and so on. These are the government side has become classic pork barreling, and the costs of the ULA, which I think is Boeing. And it might have been Bezos caught up there as well. But it's an order of magnitude higher than the cost that Musk has done. So, none of this would have happened without NASA's, genuine path-breaking stuff in the 60s to develop the technology that got America to the moon in the first instance. But now the government largesse going to the corporation rather than the demand side of things, so to speak, has meant that the cost of the government system are order of magnitude higher than what's come out of the private sector.
It does make sense, doesn't it, to try and drive demand rather than subsidize supply. I think that's where we often go wrong. So, for example, getting people on bikes, there's a cycle to work scheme here, so you get a subsidy. You can apply for a subsidy. If you're buying a bike and you're going to cycle to work with it, I think you get like half the price paid by the government, or a third or whatever. Oh, no, you get it's certainly tax-free anyway, but I think you also get part of the price paid for. And it would make sense with electric cars as well, with electric car subsidies, wouldn't it? If you buy an electric car, we'll give you a subsidy for that too. I mean, there's sort of, you get more parking spaces. You don't pay road tax already and stuff like that. So that's a better way of changing behavior than and you'd assume that, as we are seeing, companies are following. There's new electric car plants being developed in the UK now to meet with this demand. And plus the regulation that says, well, you've got to drive an electric car in a few years because we're going to stop people being able to buy new petrol cars.
Yeah. And again, this in terms of government money creation capability, you're better, again, to get away from the bureaucrats distorting everything argument, which is a good argument against some government activities, not all, but certainly some. This is saying we're going to do the money creation side of things. We'll create the money that lets you, buy that electric car. You decide which one to buy, and on it goes from there. But that's a useful way of getting government money creation into the system, rather than having, bureaucrats deciding which train line gets built.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, in that case, if we go back to Little Mill. So I missed your Monty Python. You were talking about Troublet Mill.
I know you did. I was actually getting worried about you, mate.
Troublet Little Mill.
Exactly, down Mill. Yeah, yeah. 14 hours a day.
I tell that to youth of today. But
they won't believe you.
But a population of 35 people, I don't know, if you had a government subsidy that said £5 per person per month, that's £60 spread over the lifetime, then maybe people will be going, well, gee, it really is worth sticking a mobile phone tower in Little Mill now. So, let's go for our life. But when it's government money just paid into stuff, not only is the danger that companies will become less efficient because they've got this government subsidy, there's also the politics behind it. So, and there's a million and one examples of that. So Queensland taxpayers, for example, I couldn't believe this at the time, subsidising the building of the Abbott Point port expansion so that it could export more coal from the Galilee Basin so it could carry an extra 70 million tonnes of coal a year. Subsidizing two issues, subsidizing the coal industry, but the government owns the ports. I mean, so maybe there's an argument that ports should be in public hands, but to provide something for the coal industry. If the coal industry wants to export coal, surely they should be paying for the port to export the coal. Otherwise, what are you going to do with it?
I mean, this comes back to the pork barreling stuff, which and we've seen Australia is made of a particularly outrageous example of that, but the Tories weren't too far behind in the UK with all their spending on the south of England. It's one of these things where it does make sense to restrain what the government can do, but let's restrain it with the knowledge of how economies actually operate, rather than having a first year economics textbook in our mental hands.
But it doesn't matter whether it's coal or whether it's something which is, not bad for the planet. If Queensland made enough cuddly toys to, and Japan had this thing about buying Australian-made cuddly toys, and there were 70 million tons of cuddly toys that needed to be exported from that port, that still wouldn't be an argument for the government to be paying a subsidy you'd be saying the cuddly toy industry needs to be, it's a cost for them of exporting. I mean, maybe they may not pay to build the port, but they'll be paying to use the port so that the port is profitable. It's a factor of them doing business. Why would the government get involved in that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to how do you decide what part, where does it make sense to have government have a physical role in the economy and where does it not? And generally speaking, I come down on the side of saying the government should be spending on large-scale infrastructure that everybody benefits from. So again, this is one a bit like the case the neoclassicals make themselves about the bee farmers deserving to be subsidised because the rest of us benefit from bees, and we need more bees than you'll get if they're just getting money out of making the honey. So you want to have a good education system. You want to have a highly educated populace in general. That's one good point for the government to be providing the money that enables that. Your transportation infrastructure is necessary. The telecommunications is necessary. Health is necessary. And all these things can frequently be done more effectively by a government sector than by a private sector, because the government sector is simply trying to provide for the need what the private corporations will do if they get into the same industry. And America, of course, is the classic example of this. They're trying to get a profit out of it. So it ends up being astronomically expensive to go for a trivial operation in America. It's trivially expensive to go for an astronomical operation in countries with a decent national health service, which used to include the UK at one stage.
Yeah, well, they're still doing okay, I guess.
It's better than the USA.
The cost on total amount spent on health in the US is twice per head of population what it is in the UK, and they have a lower life expectancy.
Yeah. So the best argument against letting the private sector do everything is the American health system.
So there's hundreds of examples of under this new scheme, hundreds of examples of existing government subsidies. These are sort of small scale. These are sort of like implemented not by the federal government level. This law is to try and control what everyone else is doing in terms of subsidies. So local authorities and the national governments. But their categories are, and all of these make sense, I think. So subsidies for culture or heritage. Subsidies for employment. Well, we can talk about that in a second. You know, if you've got a failing industry, do you support it if it's creating jobs? Energy efficiency, probably a bit of a no-brainer. Environmental protection, yes, so long as it's not being used as an excuse not to do anything else, of course. Infrastructure, which we've talked about a lot. Regional development, Boris Johnson's talking about levelling up. Well, he's got to start spending to do that because it's not going to happen magically by itself, is it? Because capital does accumulate in centres like the southeast of England. Rescue aid, so that's just COVID-related. Research and R&D. Which is an interesting one. Services of public economic interest. I haven't got a clue what they mean by that. Support for small business and training. So all of those sort of make sense, don't they? But you could end up with subsidising an awful lot in all of those categories.
Yeah, there's valid reasons for each of those. I mean, I remember when you travel as much as I've done in giving all the anti-economics talks I've given around the planet, you often get little cameos that come your way that are very illustrative. And I gave a talk in Serbia some time ago, and I was picked up, and I got my country's right, Croatia, I think maybe, pardon me, picked up in Zagreb and driven to Pula. And we went through quite a number of towns on the way, which were empty. And literally, I mean, the town was, there were no people living there anymore. And the reason was that with the opening up of trade with the European Union, as they became part of the EU, there were no local jobs, and people were simply left until the stage where the villages were empty. And then you had this, crumbling infrastructure and beautiful parts of the country no longer occupied. So if that sort of effect is going to come out of a market system which tends to concentrate economic activity and power, and you if you want to have a functional society, you want to have some dispersal, which used to happen in previous social systems. With a feudal system, of course, restricted people to particular regions. With all its flaws, a socialist system would not necessarily concentrate as much.
But when people are living on the land, you are naturally geographically dispersed because you've got to go where the food is.
Yeah, but the food production, I don't know what happened to them, but the villages were empty. And that was, to go through quite beautiful, picturesque villages around in the Adriatic region and find they were empty. It's a sign that something's going wrong with your economy when a place this beautiful goes, it gets to be empty.
Well, let's save the best to last. the common agricultural policy. Mm. I mean, I don't know what your thoughts were. It was designed to subsidize farmers. The argument from the EU was that despite the importance of food production, these are their words, farmers' income is around 40% lower compared to non-agricultural income. Agriculture depends more on weather and climate than any other sectors. So in other words, it's, you know, an uneven income for them. And there's an inevitable time gap between consumer demand and farmers being able to supply. So growing more wheat or producing more milk inevitably takes time. So, so there was a lot of support going into farmers. Mm-hmm. And yet the argument was, you know, you're giving out a lot of money to a small number of people. I think it's about 30%. Of all EU subsidies were part of the common agricultural policy, and yet 3% of the EU population are farmers. And a lot of it went to very wealthy landowners. So the Queen and the Duke of Westminster were getting farming subsidies from the EU simply because they own so much land. Mm. So, I mean, there's the idea might be sound, but the implementation was wrong because, well, it was a bureaucracy that was doing it.
Yeah, and I mean, again, you're trying to push against the idiosyncrasies of capitalism all the way through. At the same time, you might complain about the farmers, but if the food isn't produced, that's the end of the economy. And that's one of these elements that the market system doesn't necessarily reward the people who are actually the genuine essential workers. We're seeing that during COVID right now. And it happens in a systemic way that, you know, you might think you're paying too much for your food, but you're lucky you've got it. And,
How do you control the size of it, though? And that is the other issue with subsidies, isn't it? Because, I mean, part of it was, well, okay, if you produce too much butter or milk, well, maybe not milk because it's so perishable, but if you produce more of a crop this year because next year might not be so good, then we'll pay you for that overproduction. And that was one of the arguments, wasn't it, against the common agricultural policy. It encouraged overproduction. And, you know, in the early years, we were hearing all that talk of butter mountains and milk lakes and all that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how you fix that, though.
We're not saying it's easy, but you've got to be aware of the idiosyncrasies of a market economy. And one of them is what it does in terms of spatial distribution of income and economic activity. And also concentration of power. Those big landowners, you know, came about because it was profitable. I'm sure the Queen wasn't buying the land because it was unprofitable. And the same for those gigantic agribusiness companies in Europe. So you have to have some element of countervailing power, a force against the economic might in a capitalist economy. And that's partially what, you know, as poorly as it was done, the common agricultural policy is supposed to achieve, but it ended up rewarding the oligarchs rather than compensating the poor.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see, isn't it? I think you made the point that a lot of it is related to spatial distribution, isn't it? And one of the big things that Boris Johnson's saying is he's going to level up the economy. It's going to be interesting to see how he thinks he can do that without spending a lot of money in the form of subsidies to try and encourage growth in these areas. It's going to be a real test.
I've got to watch Boris Johnson again, have I?
You've got to watch him change his economic spots quite markedly, I think. Anyway, we'll leave it there for now. Good to talk. Look, next week, something that you often talk about is economics and thermodynamics. And, you know, we need more of it in economic theory. I just want to understand what's in your head on that. So we'll do that next week. Good to talk, Steve.
That's going to be a complicated one. We'll see how we go.
All right.
Okay.
Catch you next week.
Okay, bye.
And Boris Johnson announced yesterday what was going to happen to level up the UK economy. He was in Coventry. He announced a white paper. So another delaying tactic while he tries to figure out what the hell he does to deliver on his election promises to try and make sure that everyone is equally as well off. He says there should be opportunity for everyone, irrespective of where they are, but he's not really quite sure how he's going to do that. He said he's open to ideas. Email him, he even said, so long as you're not from the loony left. The loony left remain pretty loony, he said. So there's a clear message. If you are in regional Britain and you want government support, make sure you've got a Conservative MP. definitely seems to be the message, doesn't it? It's more about levelling up votes than levelling up the economy, I think. He did say it was all about leadership, so presumably in that he's saying, you know, more Tory MPs in the North, then the North will somehow become better off, apparently. We'll see on that. Of course, he doesn't need to. He doesn't want to be PM for very long, does he? Because he can't afford it, by all reports. So he doesn't really need to deliver on anything to stay in power. He can just move on to the next train wreck. I just thought I had to say that. That's it, just in case you thought we were politically unbiased on this podcast. That's it for this week. Back again with another one next week with Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Thanks for listening.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.